Now on News Talk, as part of our winter season of documentary on News Talk, producer Luke McManus investigates the Irish connections of the world's most famous detective in Was Sherlock Holmes Irish?
It's August 1980. I've just turned 8 years old and I'm standing somewhere I've never been before. It's a maze of subterranean passageways, haunted by rattling screeches and filled with strangely forceful blasts of metallic warm summer air. This is my first time in what is surely one of the world's strangest environments, the London Underground.
The next station is Baker Street.
But of all things that have stayed in my mind from that first visit, it's the mural on the platform wall that I remember most. The silhouette of a male profile, deerstalker hat, meerschaum pipe, a hawkish nose, and an intellectual forehead. Even my 8-year-old eyes instantly recognised him. This tube station was Baker Street, and the man depicted on the wall is one of the greatest creations in the history of literature. The world's most brilliant detective.
I want you to meet my old friend Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes' success is simply extraordinary. His enduring popularity is unrivaled by any other fictional character. The first collection of Holmes' stories, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, has sold more than 60 million copies since it was published in 1892, and Holmes has been played on screen by more different actors than any other fictional creation.
My name is Sherlock Holmes.
And the address is 221B Baker Street.
He is in many ways a quintessential Englishman, a brilliant eccentric, a proud patriot, a defender of the empire, and a man quite in love with the great city of London.
It is my belief, Watson, founded upon my experience, that the lowest and vilest alleys in London do not present a more dreadful record of sin than does the smiling and beautiful countryside.
But there was something I'd noticed about the Holmes stories. Sherlock's archenemy, Professor James Moriarty, and his right-hand man, Sebastian Moran, appeared to be of Irish origin. The author of the stories had an undeniably Irish surname, and even Sherlock Holmes' own Christian name had a familiar local ring. So could it be that this typical Englishman was in fact an Irishman in disguise? To find out, I decided to start with his creator, Arthur Conan Doyle. So I asked Turtle Bunbury, a historian with vast knowledge of Anglo-Irish families, what he knew about the Doyles.
The Doyles were well-to-do Catholic landowners, and I think that Arthur reckoned his forebears had come from Offaly or Leash, or the King's or Queen's County as they were then. They were stripped of their estates during the penal times, made their way to Dublin around that time. But they were certainly a prominent Catholic family. It is important that even when Arthur made it to the highest echelons of London society, he is still maintains a strong affinity to Irish Catholicism.
In his memoirs, Memories and Adventures, Doyle seems quite clear about his ethnicity.
I, an Irishman by extraction, was born in the Scottish capital when two separate lines of Irish wanderers came together under one roof.
His grandfather was John Doyle, who was born in Dublin in 1797. And there must have been a bit of wealth behind the family because John was taught how to paint landscapes by a guy called Gaspar Gabrielli, who was this brilliant fresco artist from Rome in Italy. And then he goes on to the Royal Dublin Society's drawing school, where he masters miniature portraits under John Comerford.
John Doyle moved to London to be an artist, but he began working in a form that was exploding in popularity.
Political cartoons were becoming all the rage at this time because the lithograph had just been invented or a new version of it. And he ended up working with the Times in London for 22 years and he published one political cartoon a month. They were always anonymous. He just signed them HB. They weren't like the Georgian cartoons where you see people being depicted very grotesque and fat and so on. He was certainly not a mean-spirited cartoonist. And I think many of his subjects actually expressed pleasure with their depiction, which is unusual for a cartoonist. I think ultimately a lot of his works would have been too bland for posterity. I know Thackeray, for instance, said you'll never hear anybody laughing at one of his works. His cartoons made him a wealthy man. And by the time Queen Victoria came to the throne in 1837, He owned a fashionable house in Hyde Park, and he was, yes, part of an intellectual elite of liberals that included people like Charles Dickens and Thomas More and Thackeray. Thackeray is said to have actually bounced Sir Arthur upon his knees in his childhood. There were six children. I mean, they were all pretty extraordinary in many ways, and Charles was extraordinary too, but he was a complicated man. He moved to Edinburgh and he went to work as an architect and a draftsman with the OPW in Edinburgh. His personal passion was illustration, especially fantasy scenes, and he did lovely work called A Dance Around the Moon. His mother was also Irish, and her name was Mary Foley, and she was apparently born in Lismore in County Waterford in 1837. Her father was a Dublin doctor who died young, and then her mother, Catherine Foley, had relocated to Edinburgh and had a little boarding house, which is where Charles Altamont Doyle came to stay, and he met Mary, and that was how they got together.
Edinburgh was where Arthur Conan Doyle was born in 1859 at 11 Picardy Place, where the only remaining link is a pub called the Conan Doyle. Just across the road from the pub is a large statue of Sherlock Holmes, standing with one hand on his hip, his pipe in the other, wearing his signature cloak and deerstalker. The plaque reads, "In memory of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, born on 22nd of May 1859, close to this spot." The plinth it stands on is about 6.5 feet high. Holmes's feet are actually invisible from where I'm standing at the bottom of the plinth. But there's a little ledge here. I'm just gripping the top of the plinth with one hand and standing up on the ledge, and you can just about see between Holmes's feet is the footprint of an enormous hound.
Professor Owen Dudley Edwards, another Irishman living in Edinburgh, is a historian and biographer of Conan Doyle. I found him at home in the suburb of Liberton, his flat dominated by teetering towers of books and papers.
Certainly, Irish Roman Catholics coming to Edinburgh, as they did in most cities around the world, flocked around the local churches. And the cathedral in Edinburgh, St. Mary's, was quite near the flat in Picardy Place, where Arthur Conan Doyle's grandmother from Ireland established herself with her daughters and took in a lodger, Charles Altamont Doyle.
Although the marriage was to prove a troubled one, it began with great optimism.
Charles Altamont Doyle's father had been a tremendously successful figure in the world of political art, the leader of it. So from that point of view, he would be a very acceptable figure to introduce to Mrs. Foley and her daughter, and in due course the marriage takes place, and the family set up. There were many children, but the third child was the first son, Arthur Ignatius Conan Doyle. I found the birth certificate, which gave us this information. Afterwards, they removed to Portobello. They moved again to a residence, Sheen's Place, where the poorer side of the street was the Catholics, and the richer side of the street was the Protestants. And if you remember in the Sherlock Holmes stories, there are all of these lovely descriptions in the earliest stories, A Study in Scarlet, The Sign of Four, of the Baker Street Irregulars, the little street boys running around the place whom Holmes relies on so much.
From The Sign of Four.
There came a swift pattering of naked feet upon the stairs, a clatter of high voices, and in rushed a dozen dirty and ragged little street Arabs. There was some show of discipline among them, despite their tumultuous entry, for they instantly drew up in line and stood facing us with expectant faces. One of their number, taller and older than the others, stood forward with an air of lounging superiority, which was very funny in such a disreputable little scarecrow.
And it's pretty clear from Conan Doyle's memoirs, though he doesn't put it quite as explicitly as this, that he was the leader, or at least the chief fighter, of a street gang. But if you look into it, it's clear that it was a Catholic gang. He tells a story about coming home and his mother saying, "Where did you get that black eye?" And he says, "You should see Eddie Tulloch's eye." Tulloch was the nephew of the local Baptist minister. As I discovered, it was a sectarian fight.
Even today, Irish identity in Scotland is often expressed in sectarian hostility. And there was another aspect to Conan Doyle's childhood that is perhaps typically Irish. His long-suffering mother, who laboured under the shadow of an alcoholic husband.
The family covered it up, and Conor Doyle certainly, while indicating his father was not well, doesn't explain why. But there was a combination of epilepsy and alcoholism which had the effect of ultimately causing the marriage would be broken up for a time. Conan Doyle himself was taken out here, where we're recording, to Liberton to be kept away from his alcoholic father.
And he lost his job at the OPW because his works and his temperament were becoming increasingly macabre. And eventually he moved into a nursing home for alcoholics and later to what was then called a lunatic asylum. Later on in life, Arthur recalls his father, a dull, vacant, leering face, mumbling and chuckling like a monkey.
Andrew Lysaght is the author of Arthur Conan Doyle, The Man Who Created Sherlock Holmes.
You know, it was important that young Arthur, who showed great talent, was a very bright young lad, you know, should be educated well. His sort of wider family rallied round, and they decided that they would send him to a well-known Catholic public school because his father was ineffectual and that Arthur might at some stage have to kind of look after the rest of his family, as it were.
Owen Dudley Edwards sees the feverish fingerprints of Doyle's father Charles throughout the pages of Sherlock Holmes.
The sign of four makes Sherlock Holmes a much fuller character and also brings him in as a drug addict.
I can strongly recommend a 7% solution of cocaine.
Now, that's obviously Charles Alderman Doyle alcoholism. Really works itself out in Holmes's drug dependence and Watson's disapproval of it.
Would you care to try it?
No, indeed. I speak not only as your friend, but as a medical man. How can you risk such damage to the great powers with which you have been endowed?
I cannot tell you how it clarifies and stimulates the mind.
Yes, and destroys it.
So that aspect, the delicate nervous energy and its danger of being smashed, that's Charles Altamont Doyle. The other way Charles Altamont Doyle comes into the story is fairly horrible descriptions of alcoholics who are fathers. It comes out particularly in The Return of Sherlock Holmes, which he wrote after his father died. One story, for example, Black Peter, in which the corpse was a man who used to get madly drunk and flog his wife and daughter through the village until their screams woke up the entire place.
The biographers agree that Sherlock Holmes is named after Oliver Wendell Holmes, the physician turned author who Doyle greatly admired. But that familiar Christian name divides the experts.
See, Sherlock is certainly a name that you will find in Waterford and Wexford, the bit of Ireland that he knew. Sherlock was in fact quite a prominent name in the 1880s, just when he was starting out writing. There was a Lord Mayor of Dublin who was Sherlock. There was a Sherlock who wrote a biography of Parnell, and again, one which he could quite easily have picked up. He did a great deal of reading, and he obviously read a great deal of Irish history.
My theory is actually that there was a fellow pupil of his at Stonyhurst, the school that he went to in Lancashire. His name was Patrick Sherlock. Sherlock is an ancient Irish family, perhaps originally of English origin, but you know they were established in Ireland for 4 or 5 centuries.
From the school records, it seems that Patrick Sherlock was far from the cleverest of Doyle's classmates. But now he's immortalised in the name of a fictional genius.
When I was there and going, I was careful to go through all of the roles of the students. And yes, I found a Holmes. I don't think that is significant. I found a Watson. I don't think that is significant. But I found two Moriartys. One of them was a boy who won second prize in mathematics in the entire school. It was obviously a sensational thing. The Moriarty of the Sherlock Holmes stories won reputation at a very young age for a treatise on the binomial theorem, which had a European vogue. I'm quoting from Holmes. The other Moriarty we know a great deal about. John Francis Moriarty grew up to become a barrister and a very unscrupulous one, and ultimately a Lord Justice. He was a most extraordinary chancer. Now, several things about him are very like Moriarty. The most obvious one was that both of them apparently had the capacity to wave their heads from side to side. The point in the case of Moriarty is very clearly brought out by an episode when he was cross-examining a lady on a case to do with her hotel. She described the hotel with great delight and great pleasure. Moriarty stood up to cross-examine, waved his head and shoulders from side to side, and then said, "So you live in this earthly paradise, ma'am, a regular Garden of Eden, is it not? Tell me, ma'am, do you have any serpent there?" "Oh, no, Sergeant, but we'd always be delighted to see you." Complete collapse of cross-examination. I think he probably did remember John Francis Moriarty as an extremely unscrupulous schoolfellow and decided, okay, that would do very nicely for the name he wanted.
So according to Dudley Edwards, a combination of the two Moriartys, the unscrupulous advocate and the mathematical prodigy, sowed the seeds of this great villainous creation. But in Cork City, another professor, Des McHale, is convinced the origins of the great villain lie closer to home.
Ordinary criminals don't interest Holmes because they're so easy to overcome. So you need somebody who is very subtle. It was very good, the whole series of stories, that he invented such a character. He appears in only three stories, but he is omnipresent because Holmes feels that the whole crime scene in London has been organised by him and that he can see the hand of Moriarty in almost everything.
He is the Napoleon of crime, Watson. And I'm ready to close on him.
If he doesn't close upon you first.
Des McHale is professor of mathematics at University College Cork and is a firm believer that Moriarty was based on one of his predecessors, the great mathematician George Boole.
James Moriarty was a mathematician, had a professorship in one of the smaller provincial universities, which would fit with University College Cork very well. If you look at the papers he wrote The Dynamics of an Asteroid. He also wrote a treatise on the binomial theorem, which seems a little bit naive, but there are aspects of the binomial theorem that do lead to advanced mathematics. It's not just a leaving cert topic. So what I've done is I've gone through the papers that Moriarty is supposed to have written, and I've been able to correlate them very closely with the actual papers that Boole had written. And certainly some of the advanced stuff that Boole did was very much like the binomial theorem in a more advanced mathematical form. Boole wrote papers on asteroids, but he wrote papers on... There's actually an asteroid named after Boole. That's a nice connection. But I've come up with about 20 points of comparison where I feel that the two are very alike. Suppose we're looking for somebody who was a logician and a mathematician and equal and opposite to Holmes in every way. Wouldn't he make a great model? And the clincher for me is to put up the two portraits of the two, the one known photograph of George Boole and the one known illustration in the Sherlock Holmes stories by Sidney Paget, and they look very, very alike, as if one is based on the other. It is a very, very convincing case.
Sharp enough and brilliant enough to outwit the great Sherlock Holmes himself.
And the link to me is H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells was a friend of Conan Doyle's, and H.G. Wells definitely did hate and dislike the Booles, and there's documentary evidence in that.
Who are you?
Jim Moriarty.
Hi.
So they just took this saintly genius and they turned him upside down, they inverted him, and they just turned him into an absolute manic criminal. What? Almost as if his mind had been perverted in some way.
Brilliant.
Isn't it?
So both heroes and villains of Doyle's writings were drawn from his Irish background.
Ireland was a significant factor in Conan Doyle's childhood. I think only age of about six, his mother took him over to Ireland. He stayed with, I think, what he described as well-to-do relations in what was then King's County. He was working in the stables. Suddenly, there was a sort of rabble outside, and Conan Doyle was clearly quite frightened of them.
From the loft window, we saw a gang of rough men, 20 or so, slouching along the road. When they came opposite to the gate, they stopped and, looking up, shook their fists and cursed at us. The groom answered back most volubly. Afterwards, I understood that these men were a party of Fenians and that I had had a glimpse of one of the periodical troubles which poor old Ireland has endured. Perhaps now, at last, they may be drawing to an end.
Conan Doyle described himself as a liberal unionist. He retained a kind of a strongly radical streak.
And this radical streak meant that when Doyle did encounter a powerful voice advocating for home rule, he was ripe for persuasion.
He was converted to support Home Rule by Roger Casement. Roger Casement exposed the slave regime of torture and murder and endless exploitation in the Congo by King Leopold II. Conan Doyle became more interested in it, supported Casement, got to know him, and also he made Casement a character in not a Sherlock Holmes story, but in one of the Professor Challenger stories, The Lost World, where they go to South America to find dinosaurs. Lord John Roxton, the initial basis of him was Roger Casement. He has Roxton exposing slavery, and he obviously enthralled Conan Doyle by the authenticity of his material. So as I say, there is this very strong affection on Conan Doyle's part for Roxton stroke Roger Casement. Casement converted Conan Doyle to Home Rule. Conan Doyle went public and explained why he was now in favour of it. And then war took place and Casement declared in favour of the Germans.
Though Doyle had embraced Home Rule, the pair parted ways when Casement took the German side. Doyle wrote,
"I would venture to say one word here to my Irish fellow countrymen of all political persuasions. If they imagine that they can stand politically or economically while Britain falls, they are woefully mistaken. The British fleet is their one shield. If it be broken, Ireland will go down. They may well throw themselves heartily into the common defence, for no sword can transfix England without the point reaching Ireland behind her."
So is there a definitive answer to the question of whether Conan Doyle was Irish, and indeed whether Sherlock Holmes was Irish?
We must realise here that there is what I might call overlapping nationalisms. That you can think of yourself as British, you can think of yourself as Scottish. That kind of multi-tier attitude to nationalism and of self-identification, Conan Doyle just one of very many people, he would have said he was Irish and he would have said it with a good deal of pride. So from that point of view, yes, he would think of himself as Irish.
His sense of self was Irish and both his mother and paternal grandparents Irish. So I think we can definitely claim Arthur Conan Doyle as one of us. And if Sherlock Holmes is his literary child, one named after an Irishman, then maybe we can claim him as well. He'd certainly qualified to represent Ireland at football, and that's good enough for me. But the other big unanswered question about Sherlock Holmes is why he remained so popular. After the break, I'll be trying to find out.
You're listening to Was Sherlock Holmes Irish on News Talk 106 to 108.
Before the break, we enlisted Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes as members of that broadest and rowdiest of clubs, the Irish diaspora. I'm now trying to figure out just why Sherlock Holmes continues to be such a successful creation. I've decided to go back where I started, to Baker Street in London.
The next station is Baker Street.
221B isn't there anymore, if it ever existed at all. In its place, there's a bank built in the 1920s. But up the street, an enterprising tourist trapper has taken over number 239 and shamelessly painted the number 221B above the door. There's even a knockoff of one of London's famous blue plaques screwed into the wall and a long queue of visitors waiting outside. How come you're so interested in coming here?
He's just cool. Sherlock's just really cool and amazing and clever. You can tell that it's sort of the autistic sort of traits and things like that as well are quite interesting with Sherlock. And it's just like there's nobody that thinks like Sherlock. It's like it's an amazing character that someone's conjured up in the back. It's crazy.
What do you mean? He's real, isn't he?
No, he's not. He is real in my mind.
Where have you come from?
From Poland. Yeah, we're from Poland. We will be here only for 4 days. So this was as a crucial point. It's a main point of our visit. A really wise person is like a Sherlock Holmes, or every one of us would like to be like Sherlock Holmes.
For me, it's definitely his genius and how quick his mind works and how he can make connections. And I've read some of the books. I haven't read all of the stories, but I've watched all of the TV shows, and I think it's fascinating. I think my favorite character is probably John. And I think it's a relationship that we don't see a lot these days, is that that really close kind of, I guess, a bromance between these two guys that never really turns romantic, but then it's still very, like, very close and knit, and you don't realize how much they mean to each other until stuff that's bad happens. They can either connect to Sherlock, who's like this cold, unfeeling brain, or they can connect to John, who is more of a heart.
You are like millennials, or maybe younger even, but you're still connecting to this guy.
Yeah, because there's a bunch to connect to, yeah.
Sherlock Holmes was far from an instant hit, but as Professor Claire Clark of Trinity College told me, in order to find his audience, the detective needed an innovative publication.
Arthur Conan Doyle, who is as yet rather untroubled by success, he has written two novels starring a detective called Sherlock Holmes, which haven't really made much of an impact, either critically or commercially. What he does is he goes to a new publication called The Strand magazine and suggests to them that he would like to resurrect Sherlock in a series of interconnected stories. One of the editors runs into the other editor's office and says, "This is the most exciting short story writer since Edgar Allan Poe." That moment is basically central to the trend that emerged then in the 1890s for short story detective fiction, that readers read about detectives and followed detectives every month. They were waiting for the new installment featuring their latest detective.
I take it the new issue of the Strand magazine is out, containing another of your slightly lurid tales.
It is indeed.
And what do you call this one?
I call it A Scandal in Bohemia. Not a bad title, eh?
So talk to me a bit about this magazine.
It was founded by a really interesting guy called George Newnes, who was really determined to become an entrepreneur of some sort. And he tried his hand at various things and eventually went into publishing and came up with a magazine called Titbits, which sounds kind of rude, but is actually just a magazine which had lots of little snippets of interesting news from all across the world. So in a way, it's a kind of like almost like a proto internet type thing, where he was collating information from other newspapers and publishing these very short snippets of interesting information.
Kind of like a Victorian Twitter.
Right, exactly. It was that sort of thing. What he decided he wanted to do for his next project was try and target the newly emerging middle class in Britain. The type of people who maybe worked in London and travelled to work on the train and needed something to read on their journey. So it combines kind of things like biographies of famous people, articles about science, and then short fiction. And the idea was that you could kind of dip in and out of it. No article would take you any longer than 20 or 30 minutes to read. And it proved tremendously popular. The first edition sold around 200,000 copies. By the middle of its first year, which was 1891, they had Arthur Conan Doyle on board, and he was publishing one Sherlock Holmes story a month. And after that, the sales really took off. So we're talking about maybe 500,000 copies a month on the third Thursday of the month, which was the day that the magazine was published. Libraries opened their doors later than normal. So rather than closing at 5, they stayed open to 9 because there was such a demand for people wanting to come and read the Sherlock Holmes stories. So it just shows you how quickly and how much it took off. But almost as soon as that happened, he started to want to get away from his most famous creation. He started to think about an exit strategy.
If you must record my exploits, I do wish you'd put less emphasis on the melodramatic and more on the intellectual issues involved.
He was on holiday with his wife and they visited the Reichenbach Falls, and he said, you know, I think this would make a good grave for Sherlock. And he said, you know, I was a bit worried that I might have to bury my bank account along with him, because he was very well paid for the stories for the Strand, extraordinarily more well paid than any other writers would have been for that publication. A lot of writers were really able to embrace the idea of themselves as workers, as people who would just write what the public wanted to read. But Doyle had a more kind of old-fashioned, almost romantic with a capital R, conception of artistic genius. and he wanted to write kind of highbrow, as he saw it, romantic historical novels, and that he felt was really his art. And he didn't want to be known as somebody who wrote these kind of short popular stories. I mean, we know that that didn't really work out for him. It's kind of sad in a way, but you know, his historical novels got a decent audience, but nothing like the popularity that he had with Holmes.
Holmes was a publishing sensation. And as Rob Byrne, an expert on silent film, told me, it wasn't long before others came looking for a piece of the action.
Back in 1893, when Arthur Conan Doyle decided he was going to stop writing the Sherlock Holmes stories, there was a great outcry. People wanted more stories, thespians wanted to bring in the stage, and it was a couple of years after that when William Gillette met with Conan Doyle in person that Conan Doyle realized that Gillette was Sherlock Holmes, that he was the man that could bring Holmes to the stage.
Previously hostile to theatrical adaptations, Doyle was persuaded by Gillette's considerable fame, and it must be said, the promise of riches.
It promises to be a very big thing. My agent says there are thousands of pounds in it. So we are cheerful. But no chickens have been either hatched or counted. Only a couple of palpable eggs.
Money aside, Doyle appears to have been quite hands-off in his attitude to the adaptation. When Gillette inquired if he could marry Holmes off, Doyle replied,
"You may marry him, murder him, do anything you like to him."
He wrote a four-act play called Sherlock Holmes. Gillette went on to play the role for his entire career, over 1,300 performances, and basically created the character, created him as much as Conan Doyle.
Wait, what? Did Rob just tell me that William Gillette created Holmes as much as Conan Doyle did? That can't be right.
It was Gillette that actually gave us the bent pipe and the deerstalker cap and the magnifying glass. The character of Holmes really came and has been passed down to us from Gillette and not from Conan Doyle.
But though the stage was one thing, the most exciting entertainment of that age was a new craze called the cinema.
Now, the film is the only time that Gillette ever appeared on film. This was a one and only time. And the film, once after it was released, was lost. It was a small studio, they made a limited number of prints. And by the time anybody really cared about the film, there were no known surviving copies. It was the holy grail of Sherlockania. All the people that had played Sherlock after that was sort of passed down from that, but the origin was gone. It was discovered in the vaults of the Cinémathèque Française. So when this came to light, they confidentially contacted us and we agreed to collaborate on the restoration and then make the announcement in the fall of 2012, the discovery. We had no idea of the reaction, the level of the reaction that we were going to get from the world, which was simply amazing. People were clamoring to see the character in flesh and blood, and it was Gillette that created that. And it was from Gillette and from people that had seen Gillette at the time that he carried on to the next generations of people that played him. And it's almost like a game of tag in the great actors and some not so great actors that have portrayed Holmes on the screen over the years. But each one is sort of a lesser generation or another generation past, but they all even unknowingly reference the original and reference Gillette.
The William Gillette feature film of Sherlock Holmes wasn't exactly a blockbuster, but it did start a cinematic phenomenon. The combination of Doyle's genius and Gillette's inspired visualization have produced a character for the ages. And the list of actors who've played him is almost endless. There are a few versions of Holmes that are quite definitive. Basil Rathbone's from the Golden Age of Hollywood, Jeremy Brett's twitchy ITV Holmes in the 80s and 90s, and most recently Benedict Cumberbatch's contemporary version on the BBC. In China, the BBC Sherlock regularly attracts TV audiences of almost 100 million. Nearly 2 million people showed up when the Christmas special was screened in the cinemas there. Colin McCarthy, like Doyle before him, a Scottish-born son of Irish parents, is one of the directors who have brought this latest version of Holmes to life.
I remember seeing the Basil Rathbone films, the old black and white films. They used to show them on BBC Two every night of the week, and I thought they were brilliant, and I got this book of the complete Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes. I absolutely loved them. There's something about those stories that's incredibly captivating.
Still writing your mystery stuff?
Yes, there's a new one out this week.
Yeah, when I saw the first episodes of the Stephen Moffat, Mark Gatiss kind of modernization of Sherlock Holmes, despite being kind of wary of it at first, when I saw it, I thought it was brilliant, really well handled. And I went and did Doctor Who, which Stephen Moffat is the showrunner on as well as Sherlock, and off the back of that, we got chatting about Sherlock, and then they offered me one to do. It was kind of like a childhood fantasy getting fulfilled, the idea of getting to go and direct, because the TV show is a feature-length TV show, so it's kind of like getting to go and do a Sherlock Holmes movie. That's what it felt like. I had an amazing script. I had like some of the best actors in the world, and I was hugely enthusiastic about it. So it was a piece of piss, to be honest. Can you put that on the radio? I don't know.
Can you put your finger on the appeal of this character?
Sherlock is the ultimate human being in a lot of ways, in that, you know, what separates humans from animals is our intellectual capacity. Sherlock presents the idea that that intellect is a benign thing.
You're ordinary, you're on the side of the angels.
Oh, I may be on the side of the angels, but don't think for one second that I am one of them.
We all aspire to being the smartest version of ourselves that we can. Our way of dealing with problems is always to kind of think our way out of them. So the more you can think, the more you can deal with your problems. Sherlock can unlock the secrets of the world around himself all the time, and we're all confused and baffled by a world that we should be able to understand, you know? And I think we all feel like if we're smart enough, we can somehow cheat life and not have any problems because we can work everything out, you know? He offers that as a possibility to us all. But Stephen said to me something that was really useful, which is nobody really cares about the crime case in Sherlock. What they care about is John and Sherlock and their relationship.
Any reputation I have for mental acuity and sharpness comes in truth from the extraordinary contrast John so selflessly provides.
Getting to play with, you know, the wedding and the best man speech and the stag night, getting to do the pub crawl thing with them, that was a lot of fun. And I guess that's probably the sort of standout moment from that Sherlock, that and the kind of almost bringing you to tears, the unexpected best man speech.
I am the most unpleasant, rude, ignorant, and all-round obnoxious arsehole that anyone could possibly have the misfortune to meet. So if I didn't understand I was being asked to be best man, it is because I never expected to be anybody's best friend. And certainly not the best friend of the bravest and kindest and wisest human being I have ever had the good fortune of knowing.
Barry McCrae is Professor of English at Notre Dame University and is also editor of the Oxford University Press's Selected Sherlock Holmes Stories.
Do you have any idea why this character fascinates so deeply?
One of the things to look at, I suppose, is what remains constant in all of these adaptations of Holmes and what is changeable. Because one thing you think that we're attracted to is the depiction of Edwardian or late Victorian London, these gaslit alleys and cabbies and everything. The adaptations show that that is absolutely not essential. There's the Basil Rathbone ones, there's the one set in Nazi Germany, there's the famous one now, the BBC one set in contemporary London with text messages. The historical period and setting is completely disposable. So what is not dispensable? One of them, I think, is that Holmes has to be single. Nobody can ever marry Holmes off. We wouldn't feel it was our Holmes if he was sitting there with a wife. We have to have a Watson. And they have to sort of cohabit and sort of not cohabit.
And I think of this title of A Scandal in Bohemia, which was the first story. And I suppose there is something essentially bohemian about their existence. And I think that's actually a word Watson uses to describe his own life, that, yeah, we'll get up and go out the door at 2 a.m., we'll take drugs, we'll shoot bullet holes in the wall. The rules of life don't apply to two guys living together. It's the ultimate bromance.
Yes, yeah. It's also that bit of life, like the bromance bit of life when you're independent but not settled. But in their case, they're permanently unsettled, but it's also safe. There's something about their bohemia that's safe. Once you close the door of Baker Street, you don't feel any of that is going to come in and bother them. But it's something that we recognize, even if we've never obviously lived it, but it's something that seems recognizable and somehow comforting, I think. Well, and also there's the fantasy of the glamorous friend, I think, too, because Watson is obviously our way into the stories. So he's our point of view. He's a bit like us. He's actually a bit slower than us, which is important. So we're not as clever as Holmes, but we're a little bit clever than Watson. So we can sometimes see the writing on the wall a little before he can. But he brings us into this world, and his kind of awe of his great friend is something we share. And that's another, it's a kind of a young fantasy too, I suppose, when of a certain age of moving to the city and just meeting amazing friends that are just going to be like nobody ever met before. They won't be like the people back home. They're just going to change your life completely. I think there's Watson's very touching, really unadulterated admiration for Holmes that I think we get to share in too. I think that's a big part of it. There are a few moments when Holmes sort of gallantly protects Watson or says, you know, there's no finer man, or these few very stiff upper lippy, but, you know, for all that felt moments, that, you know, where Holmes is shows us that he feels something for Watson, but they're so restrained and there's so few. And there's always the slight feeling that maybe he doesn't care about him all that much. We all feel that Holmes gets jealous when Watson gets married. That seems to be clear even in the stories. But it's not exactly sexual jealousy. It's a different kind. It's sort of a nostalgia, I suppose, which is something that we all share too. He is a bit of a Peter Pan figure in that too. That, you know, Watson, you know, it's like the song the Summer of 69, Jimmy quit, Joey got married. Like, it's sort of that kind of inevitable progress of life where the gang of lads, you know, they slowly peel away to the exigencies of grown-up life. Holmes is also immune to that. He doesn't have to. He just can go on forever being Holmes. He's one of the guys who just keeps going. But that he also gives Watson occasional access to that again. You know, he can leave Mary at home. She's extremely understanding about that. And he, every so often, he moves in with Holmes and they relive their great adventure days. I suppose that is a big part of it.
In The Three Garadebs, Watson is shot and we get a glimpse of Holmes's true devotion.
You're not hurt, Watson. For God's sake, say that you're not hurt.
It was worth a wound. It was worth many wounds to know the depth of loyalty and love which lay behind that cold mask. The clear, hard eyes were dimmed for a moment, and the firm lips were shaking. For the one and only time, I caught a glimpse of a great heart, as well as of a great brain. All my years of humble but single-minded service culminated in that moment of revelation.
It's nothing, Holmes. It's a mere scratch.
He had ripped up my trousers with his pocket knife.
You're right,
he cried, with an immense sigh of relief.
It's quite superficial.
His face set like flint as he glared at our prisoner, who was sitting up with a dazed face.
By the Lord, it is as well for you. If you had killed Watson, you would not have got out of this room alive.
You, I think, discussed psychoanalysis, which was obviously one of the great intellectual trends of that period in the context of these stories. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Whether it's the influence of psychoanalysis itself on the stories, or we can just see that the Holmes stories and theories of psychoanalysis came out of the same cultural soup, you might say. That seems clear to me. One of them is that small symptoms in the present can be traced back to a much bigger traumatic story in the past. And that's really the plot structure of a lot of the stories. So in the Dancing Men, for example, indecipherable scribbles start appearing on the walls of somebody's house. And these indecipherable scribbles provoke, for want of a better word, hysterical reaction in the woman of the house. She starts screaming and crying and fainting when she sees him. That looks really like one of the women that Freud treated in Vienna. Why is it that she gets this hysterical reaction to seeing just scribbles on a wall? And Holmes traces that back to a criminal conspiracy, but far away in the past and far away also geographically. And that's really the way psychoanalysis works too, that the past returns to haunt the present, but in unrecognizable ways. When the past returns to the present, it doesn't come back as itself. it comes back as some sort of strange, unexpected and unrecognizable disturbance in the present. So the classic home story begins with a distressed woman ringing on his bell. She usually won't talk about what's ailing her. That's, again, we have a very, just, you could imagine Freud in his office in Vienna, but exactly the same situation. And Holmes notices details that seem irrelevant to the person. The person is trying to tell Holmes one story, but in their words and in their appearance, he sees another story. So he says, I see you took the train. You know, he'll notice that somebody has lines in their wrist, and so he says, oh, you must be a typist. And this is what a psychoanalyst does as well, is looks at apparently superfluous details of what somebody's telling them. In other words, somebody, just as in psychoanalysis, somebody is not telling the story that they think they're telling. They're also telling another story unbeknownst to themselves, and it's Holmes' job is to see that. He listens very like a psychotherapist. And people always, like a psychoanalytic patient, get frustrated and say, but why are you on and on and on about, you know, my sister? This is not about her. This is about this mysterious man that whatever. I think that is, in a very deep way, about the same thing that psychoanalysis is about, understanding the troubles of the present from unexpected connections to the past, and also connections that people themselves can't see.
So what is the appeal of Sherlock Holmes?
That is the question which beats in my brain like a hammer.
Is Colin McCarthy right that he represents a morally centred version of our most essential human quality, our intellect? Or perhaps, as Barry McRae suggests, it's the parallels with Freud's exploration of the unconscious.
How often have I said to you that once you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth?
Or is it that raffish bohemian scenario, two men living together in the city?
The one thing that is constant, really, in all the adaptations that I can think of, is that at the end of the story, we go back to the room in Baker Street. I think for me, the attraction of Holmes is not the mystery, but the frame of the mystery. The two of them sitting, having their coffee, or cocaine in the case of Holmes. And in a way, it's sort of this fantasy of a safe place to look at and contemplate the weird vagaries of the world.
Was Sherlock Holmes Irish was produced and narrated by Luke McManus and was supported by a grant from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland as part of the Sound and Vision Scheme.